Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grieg. Hi, William. How are you doing?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing well, and I sure appreciate the opportunity to be with you this evening.
Well, we always appreciate having you, and what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I think we have to tour the horizon here with respect to an incredible confluence of developments in the economy and in the emergence of the garrison state and the consolidation of power. We're really living in what seems to be almost a climactic, the end of an episode in human history, the closing of a parenthesis here. I really don't want to sound apocalyptic, but then again, the tenor of the times is suitable for apocalyptic thoughts when you take a look at what's going on right now with the British petroleum spill, the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, the prospect of literally having petroleum precipitating from the skies and defouling the watershed and doing all kinds of havoc to people for the indefinite future. And then you sync that up with things that are happening in the Middle East right now. There's this large fleet of warships that's gone through the Suez Canal. There are reports in the Israeli press about an impending Saudi-supported U.S.-Israeli joint strike against Iran that would be catastrophic for the economy, not to mention, of course, for the Iranians. And they've suffered for six decades now on the receiving end of the supposed benevolence of the Anglo-American elite. And, of course, British Petroleum was there, interestingly enough. There are all kinds of interesting little correspondences and continuities in history. But the thing that I find interesting about what's going on with the BP spill was an item in the Wade Madsen report, which is one of these sources that sort of goes out and gather from every kind and then report by way of news tips and sort of what you'd call raw intelligence, things that appear to be going on beneath the surface of current events.
Well, let me just comment for our listeners. Wayne Madsen is an investigative reporter.
Yeah.
We've interviewed him. He's really, I've been quite intrigued by him. I think he does his good job of getting the information you're not going to get through regular channels. So go right ahead. Wayne Madsen, I think, is a very credible source of information.
Yeah. The thing about Wayne Madsen is that because he deals with sources that only he has access to, you don't know until many months later that what he has reported is reliable. And so he's one of these people who go out on a bit of a limb every once in a while and get ahead of the story. And he's been talking about sources within the Obama administration, apparently, who have revealed to him that one of the reasons for the shock maintenance and safety procedures that precipitated this BP disaster was pressure being put on BP and being put on the development of oil resources and deep drilling in the Gulf of Mexico as a way of providing an alternate source of oil in the event, and apparently in as a contingency for dealing with the impending attack on Iran and the loss of Iranian-based oil supplies and other supplies in the region, the idea being that they had to have some kind of a crash program to extract oil from that source in light of what was going to be happening pretty soon with this attack on Iran, which would mean, of course, that what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico is blowback from imperial foreign policy.
But I think most people in America really find it very difficult to believe we're going to war with Iran. After all, the Obama administration would never precipitate a war with Iran. Why, there's a break between, the Obama administration and Netanyahu, and they're not really talking. And yet, of course, just this last weekend, American flotilla, 11 ships went through the Suez Canal, moving into the Red Sea, along with an Israeli warship. If we're really at odds with Israel, why are we taking an Israeli warship along with an American flotilla? Or is it possible that nothing we're seeing is true, that everything is an illusion and a delusion, and we really are preparing for a massive war over there that's going to kill millions of people? Go right ahead.
Well, here's the specific passage from the Wayne Madsen report. dealing with the potential of overt hostilities with Iran. Quote, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, the Pentagon and Interior and Energy Departments told the Obama administration that the newly discovered 3 to 4 billion barrels of oil in the Gulf of Mexico would cover America's oil needs for up to 8 months if there was a military attack on Iran that resulted in the bottling up of the Strait of Hormuz to oil tanker traffic, resulting in a cutoff of oil to the United States from the Persian Gulf. And so, according to Mr. Madsen, what's happened here is that the elements of the federal government dealing with safety checks, enforcing safety checks and procedures, granted waivers to British Petroleum as they were conducting this deep core drilling, quote, because of the high-level interest by the White House and Pentagon in tapping the Gulf of Mexico bonanza find in order to plan a military attack on Iran without having to be concerned about an oil and natural gas shortage from the Persian Gulf after an outbreak of hostilities. If this is true, and as you point out, Mr. Manson does have a very impressive track record, and he has a way of insinuating himself into high-level conversations that deal with what's really going on as opposed to what we're being fed by the government-aligned media, then what we're dealing with right now in terms of this civilization imperiling environmental disaster that's going to become a huge economic disaster in the Gulf is sort of anticipatory blowback from the planned war with Iran. And it's interesting that you bring up this idea that there's a break between Obama and Netanyahu, and this is something we've talked about in previous weeks, Dr. Stan, the fact that this incident involving the Gaza-bound flotilla and the attack thereon by Israeli commandos and the outrage that has resonated through international circles over this. Very quietly, over the last couple of days, Israel has announced that they are going to be modifying and lifting, in many ways, the blockade on Gaza. And it was really a foolish exercise to begin with, because, as we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, the reason why Hamas is in power in Gaza right now was because they were essentially pushed into that position by the United States. The arms that are the supposed pretext for this blockade of Gaza were provided to the Gazans in a roundabout way, but specifically to Hamas in a roundabout way, by the United States and by Israel in 2006-2007. They basically set up the United States and Israel acting pretty much on behalf of the United States. They set up Fatah to fail in a civil war between those factions that was...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and here's William Greig is simply talking about Hamas and the fact that, really, if you go into the background of Hamas, why, of course, it was really armed by the United States, and yet, of course, the Israelis are furious because the Hamas has weapons. But you go into the background of Hamas, we carry a book called The Devil's Game, written by Robert Dreyfus, points out how Hamas was originally organized by the American CIA and the Israeli Mossad, working together. Why would you create Hamas? Well, supposedly we wanted to counter to the wicked Arafat, who, of course, we were also financing.
Oh, sure,
so we
yeah.
financed Arafat, we financed Hamas. There is a fascinating book out. It's called Son of Hamas, and it's really written by the son of the head of the Hamas movement in Palestine there. And suddenly this young man eventually became a Christian, but the book, the most significant part of the book to me was the story of when he finally goes to his father and he says, Father, I mean, you are the head of Hamas here in Palestine, but, I mean, who is really in charge of it? You obviously are simply a figurehead. Who's in charge? And his father, who is the head, for all intents and purposes, Hamas in Palestine, says, I really don't know who's in charge of it. I think it's somebody over in Syria. They never give me any money. They don't tell me what to do. But, I mean, certainly I don't run Hamas. I'm just the figurehead for it. Somebody else is in charge of Hamas, probably over in Syria.
Yeah.
And of course, basically, if you, people who study these things understand that the CIA is probably still running Hamas. Who was it who brought the wicked Ayatollahs to power over there in Iran back in 1979? Why, the CIA that toppled the Shah of Iran and bought the Ayatollahs to power. Nothing is as it appears to be, ladies and gentlemen. Those of you who heard my interviews with Paul Williams earlier this week on Tuesday, if you haven't heard them, go up on the internet. They're posted on my website. And he points out that it was the CIA funding that was responsible for replacing the Turkish government with people who were traditionally favorable to the United States and to Israel, and suddenly now they're aligned with Iran and opposition to Israel, thanks to American tax dollars at work. But the average individual has no idea what's really going on. They take things at face value, and you pick up the story, William.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the important aspects of this story that I think is worth pointing out here is that you've got this perception here of Israel and the United States being at odds over Gaza policy, but the Gaza policy is changing right now. The purpose of this embargo, and it wasn't just an arms embargo, it was an economic embargo, they were putting, as one member of the Knesset, of the Knesset over in Israel put it, they're putting the Gazans on a diet. And that has nothing to do with cutting off arms supplies. That's simply a way of immiserating and radicalizing a population. But the Hamas elements, the secret police, and the terrorist elements within Hamas, which is a terrorist group that was created, as you point out, as a collaborative venture between the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been funded and controlled by the CIA for decades, and Israeli intelligence. They were given arms as a result of a civil war between Hamas and Fatah that was choreographed by the United States, by the Bush administration in 2006-2007. That basically created a situation where Fatah was hung out to dry. You had these hundreds of thousands of firearms and artillery, small artillery pieces and other kinds of ordnance and hardware that fell into the hands of Hamas that had been brought into Gaza, most of it passing through the checkpoints connecting Gaza to Israel, but some of it going through the border with Egypt as well. And this is being done as a way of conscious, deliberate policy. So all the weapons that were supposedly the reason for this embargo were put into the hands of Hamas by the United States and by Israel. And now that blockade is being changed very quietly after all the Sturm und Drang over the flotilla raid. You have this very quiet change in policy because I think it served its purpose now. You have this perception here that the United States and Israel are at daggers drawn with each other. But what's happening, as you point out, Dr. Stan, is that there was this huge armada that went through the Suez Canal that included an Israeli warship. You've got news items out of both Israel and the United States and also out of some other regional news sources in the Middle East talking about Saudi Arabia being prepared passively to collaborate in an attack on Iran. And of course that has to do with rivalries and sectarian animosities between Riyadh and Tehran. You've got two completely incompatible perspectives on the Islamic faith in the Sunni and Shia rivalry here between Tehran and between Riyadh and Tehran. And Saudi Arabia has been collaborating, really, this is a story that's not gotten a whole lot of play. They've been collaborating where occasion permits with Israel and with the United States in a move to try to contain and manipulate events in Iran. Because of that rivalry, and it's all probably going to come to a head very quickly. I certainly hope it doesn't, but there's ample reason to believe that it will in a war against Iran that would be just a cataclysm, an economic catastrophe for the Western world. And if there's any doubt that we're headed toward a depression, if there's any sense that we might recover from our economic contraction right now, a war in the Persian Gulf would certainly bring to an end whatever tentative steps our economy is making in the direction of recovery. And, of course, that's not happening as well. People are talking now about how we're in the second part of a double dip. I think that's a mistake. I think we've not ended the first dip. The first dip has been proceeding very nicely, if you will, since late 2007. And now, in addition to everything that's going on in the realm of foreign policy, you've got the House and Senate trying to prepare for Independence Day, this so-called financial reform measure that is a little bit like the so-called health care reform and very much like the so-called TARP measure from October of 2008. It's something that is a measure of a vast and detailed and ambitious scope and intrusiveness. Nobody knows what it will do. Nobody knows if it will work. Nobody knows what it's supposed to accomplish. It doesn't address any of the fundamental structural problems that led to the financial collapse. It doesn't address what's going on with Fannie and Freddie, which are becoming multi-trillion dollar liabilities for the American taxpayer. And Fannie and Freddie are also becoming a real liability for people who are trying to renegotiate their mortgages as they find themselves underwater, given the fact that these two government-sponsored or government-supported entities are involved in either backstopping or owning most of the mortgages that have been issued over the last several decades. They're making it impossible, in many instances, for people who are in a position of negative equity in their homes to renegotiate the mortgages on a more favorable basis. And so people are thinking about what is now called strategic default. That is to say, walking away from your mortgage, simply sending jingle mail to your bank or your mortgage lender by mailing them the keys and just walking away. That's something that's gone on intermittently over the last 10 or 12 years, actually, but is something that's really gained traction in the last year and a half or so, given what's going on with the collapse of the housing and mortgage bubble. But what's happening is that Fannie and Freddie, Fannie particularly, is promoting the use of the courts now to try to find some way of punishing those who do what many big taxpayer-supported entities have done, which is basically walk away from a debt that they can't pay and that they can't get other people to pay on their behalf, which is something that Wall Street has been doing since 2008, very promiscuously. But there's a move on now with the support of Fannie in about 39 states to use civil judgments against people who walk away from their mortgages to go after their other assets, whether you're talking about cars, whether you're talking about other forms of real property or bank accounts or any other kind of financial assets. You know, Fannie and Freddie are soaking down hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies. They're keeping their corporate apparatchiks very well cared for in terms of salary and perquisites and benefits. And these are people who generally do nothing. I mean, this is a sinecure if you end up in the employee of Fannie or Freddie. But while they're soaking down all this largesse from the taxpayers, extorted at gunpoint by the government ruling us, they're using the courts to try to take away basically anything of value from people who can't get banks to renegotiate mortgages in the circumstances we're in right now. If you didn't have the moral hazard created by government intervention here in the first place, you wouldn't have all these bad loans. You wouldn't have all these mortgages going bad because people who didn't qualify wouldn't have gotten the loans to begin with if the Federal Reserve hadn't manipulated the money supply and the interest rates, and if you didn't have this big push during the late Clinton and Bush administrations to expand homeownership into areas of the population where you had people who simply weren't qualified. But beyond that, you have another type of moral hazard where because the lending agencies and the financials who are behind, who own the paper, rather, on these bad mortgages, because they can get what they want from the taxpayers, they have no incentive to sit down and negotiate to find ways of liquidating bad debts by sitting down and negotiating with people who want in good faith to get better terms for mortgage loans that they can no longer afford. And so you've got this really nasty dynamic here where you've got subsidized Shylocking going on, and Fannie and Freddie are deeply involved in it. This financial reform measure, which apparently was finished early this morning, at least the draft of it coming out of the Senate was finished early this morning, doesn't have anything to do with Fannie and Freddie. It's, of course, not going to have anything to do in terms of trying to impose some kind of accountability on the Federal Reserve. As a matter of fact, it goes in exactly the opposite direction by enhancing the powers of the Federal Reserve and creating a new financial commissar who'll be able to seize financial firms at will and write regulations of his own creation and enforce them any way he sees fit. Basically just picking up whatever's left from the October Revolution of 2008 in terms of creating an economic dictatorship in this country.
Well, I think we're moving into very, very difficult times, ladies and gentlemen. But we see we haven't even gotten to the commercial loan collapse. That's one of the next tsunamis. And remember, the commercial loans are coming up probably in 2012, 2013. And you've got, half a trillion dollars in commercial loans. And then you got the derivative bubble. That's about $500 trillion, something like that. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, William.
It's interesting when you talk about...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Don't know. We don't know whether it's going to work or not. It's going to be interesting to see what's going to, well, in essence, we don't know what this is going to do, but we're going to wait and see. This is the legislation he just finished writing. Go ahead.
Yeah. No one will know until this is actually in place how it works, but we believe we've done something that has been needed for a long time. it took a crisis to bring us to the point where we could actually get this job done. Now think about that for a second. This guy is as culpable as anybody on Capitol Hill in helping to bring about this crisis. And now that the crisis is upon us and people are being ruined by the tens of millions, and you have this destruction of literally trillions of dollars in notional wealth, and this huge consolidation of power over the financial markets, now people literally are being reduced to penury. Within the next few years, we're going to see people starving in the streets of this country. Write that down in ink. That's going to happen here. But as far as he's concerned, this is all, if you will, in concept, a good thing, because the crisis was necessary in order to accomplish this. Well, what is the this that was so valid and necessary? Well, it was the creation of this new office within the Federal Reserve that will further strengthen its power over what remains of the financial markets and over the banking industry in this country. And he admits, Mr. Dodd, first thing, right out of the chute, that nobody knows how this will work and nobody knows if this will work. That's how it was reported in the Washington Post. In the Wall Street Journal, we read the following. If the bill passes, President Barack Obama is expected to sign the package into law by July 4th. Thursday's agreement also gives the president leverage going into a weekend summit of world leaders in Canada. That's the G20 summit going on right now, where he will prod other nations to rewrite their rules. In other words, you're talking about harmonization here of these dictatorial corporatist measures. And one of the things that's happening in the G20 summit in Canada right now is that, ironically enough, the United States is to the left of Europe on matters of spending and government intervention in the financial markets. And that's a remarkable thing. There's been something of a Damascene conversion, not really, but beginnings of it, on the part of at least some people in Europe, the Germans in particular, because they're the ones who are paying for all of this. When they've seen what's happened in Greece, and they've seen what's happened in Hungary, and what's happening in the Iberian Peninsula with Spain and Portugal about to blow up, and they hear rumblings coming out of Great Britain, and all this, of course, has to do with decades of concentrated government profligacy, and the fact that the parasite class has now completely overgrown the productive to the point where the parasites are killing the hosts. It's gotten to the point now where the Europeans, the people who are in the Eurozone, are talking about austerity and examining the possibility of cutting back, at least in terms of the rate of growth of government spending and government intervention. But you've got the Obama administration now urging them to toward greater prodigality in terms of their spending.
Well, I think it's important. What they're really talking about is spending yourself into prosperity. Just keep spending money and spending money, and that's how you're going to get prosperous. But if you don't have any money, how are you going to do it? What's really so interesting in Europe is the southern part, they call it the Mediterranean nations. Right now in Greece, you can retire when you're 60. They wanted to raise the retirement age to 62, and they're having riots and demonstrations over there that they dare to do that. Well, the Germans are hardworking people, and they don't want to have to finance this. And so basically you have Germany and Northern Europe saying, we want to get back and start restricting spending. England's doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. They're talking about a 25% cut in government expenditures.
Yeah.
And what are they talking about down in Southern Europe? Well, things are going to go that same way, because we can always get the money from Germany. And Germany's saying, we're not going to put up the money for you.
Sure.
And suddenly Germany and England are talking about doing what's responsible. And what's the Obama administration saying? No, you don't understand. The solution to getting out of debt is to spend more money. Go right ahead.
Literally, it's as if you have people from the, I don't know if you remember back in the late Gilded Age in New York City, the Carnegies and people of that social echelon were part of a group called the 400, like the 400 most prominent, wealthy, and influential people in New York, the people that are running that corporatist system. But it's almost as if you had somebody, say John Jacob Astor and Andrew Carnegie or somebody, going into the Bowery section and forcing bums to go and donate blood in order to buy them dinner. I mean, that's the sort of a situation that we're finding ourselves in, is we're being bled dry in order to keep those people, those corrupt elites, the lifestyle to which they're accustomed.
Well, I think this is done intentionally. I think they're going to destroy our economy. They're going to impoverish our people. They know what they're doing. But is there any better way to destroy a great nation than to debauch the currency? No, I mean, that's what Alan Greenspan said in his book, The Age of Turbulence. Get it out, read it. They know what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen. They just don't want you to know, and you're going to end up being impoverished and a pauper. Well, William, you go right ahead.
By way of giving a flavor of what's going on this week up in Canada, in Toronto, the G20 summit, it's useful to take a look at the following report from today's CBC News. Police forces in charge of security at the G20 summit in Toronto have been granted special powers for the duration of the summit. The new powers took effect Monday and apply along the border of the G20 security fence that encircles a portion of the downtown core. This area, the so-called Red Zone, includes the Metro Toronto Convention Center, where delegates will meet. The new regulations effectively expand the jurisdiction of the existing Public Works Act to apply to high-security areas of the summit site. Under the new regulations, anyone who comes within 5 meters of the security area is obliged to give police their name and state the purpose of their visit on request. Anyone who fails to provide identification or explain why they are near the security zone can be searched and arrested. Now, this was passed on June the 2nd without legislative debate. It's been referred to as a secret law. This is something that wasn't made public until they had this meeting of the oligarchy, the global oligarchy there in Toronto. And that's just such a suitable metaphor for what's going on right now. They're creating basically an impenetrable, opaque barrier behind which these people are planning the future of hundreds of millions of people in terms of what goes on with their economies, whether they'll be able to make a living, whether they'll ever have the prospect of owning a home, whether they'll be able to keep the homes that they have been paying for, things of that nature. And this so-called financial reform measure is just such a perfect encapsulation of all of this, because what they're doing is they're amplifying the power of the people who created the problem to begin with, and they're doing this in the name of reform. And the guy who's shepherding this through, Christopher Dodd, just utterly oozes, reeks, separates corruption. In the Wall Street Journal, once again this morning, you can read the following summary of what happened with this compromise measure on financial reform. The most important quote in the article, I think, is what Christopher Dodd said by way of the scope of this measure. This is about as important as it gets because it deals with every single aspect of our lives. I'll think about that for a second.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we'll be back in just a moment to what we were discussing. But before we do, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog, how they can get to your radio program, and, of course, how they can get to your PayPal button.
I appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate. That's P-R-O, Pro, then L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate. If you Google William Grigg and Pro Libertate, or either of those terms, William Grigg or Pro Libertate, chances are the blog is going to be either at the top of the return list or one of the first several entries. And I try to update it about 3 times a week. I've been more consistent in that respect over the last few weeks. I've been making a concerted effort to be putting something up 3 times within a given week. And there's certainly no shortage of things to write about. Quite frankly, my biggest challenge is finding time to give adequate development to this long and growing list of things that need to be examined that are not being examined to the depth that I think is suitable and necessary. The most recent essay that I have on Pro Libertate is called When Police Kill a City, and it deals with Maywood, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, about 40,000. The official census figure is about 28,000, but there are probably 10, 20, or 25,000 people who have illegally immigrated there from Mexico have taken up permanent residence. You got a city here that is like a little pocket of the third world. It reminds me a lot of Mexico when I lived there in the early 80s, or Guatemala when I lived there a few years later, in terms of the way that the police department became sort of the island of misfit toys for people who had been chased out of every other police department in California. I mean, you literally had criminals who were given badges and guns, and they were setting up checkpoints and roadblocks, and shaking people down and abusing people so promiscuously and with such impunity that the lawsuits that were being filed against the police department ultimately led to the bankruptcy of the city government, because the California State Insurance Trust no longer was willing to extend liability insurance to the city government. So the city government's folding now. They're going to be farming out their municipal services to neighboring communities. They're going to have a rump city council that will coordinate this. And they'll have law enforcement coverage by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, which is a better arrangement anyway, because law enforcement, in the constitutional scheme of things, should be the responsibility of the county sheriff to begin with. But I took a look at this story as a microcosm of what's happening in this country, where you're having cities, counties, states that are collapsing now, going bankrupt. This is the first time, at least in recent memory, that you actually had a city fail in California. It is pretty much an artificial construct, but a community of 40,000 people is not insignificant. And this is the first time it's failed, but this is by no means the last time. Detroit is on the verge of collapse right now. I believe in the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years, or perhaps more quickly than that, you're going to see Detroit split up into several different distinct municipalities, because they're an economic moonscape right now. But Pro Libertate, the blog, deals with issues of that sort, trying to get out in front of trends. I'm trying to do in a much less comprehensive way and a more modest way, if you will, the sort of thing that Wayne Madsen does in terms of trying to get out in front of stories. That's the purpose of Pro Libertate, the blog. So Google William Grigg and or Pro Libertate to find the blog. I update it about 3 times a week. And I also have a radio program called Pro Libertate, which is broadcast on the Liberty News Radio Network, libertynewsradio.com, every Saturday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time. That's 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock California time. And Pro Libertate, the radio program, deals with the same kinds of issues that we're discussing tonight, Dr. Stan, and also the types of issues that I write about in Pro Libertate, the blog. I also write quite a bit for LouRockwell.com. Mr. Rockwell is the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and it's a tremendous publication, LouRockwell.com, probably the most widely read libertarian individualist website on the world, on the web, the World Wide Web. I write for the blog there, as well as seeing a lot of what I write at Pro Libertate being republished at LouRockwell.com. Today, the blog item I wrote this morning entitled Don't Tase My Grandma. Think about that title for a second. Don't Tase My Grandma. That blog item was published at about 7:30, and then the Drudge Report picked up on it and put a link to that item at LouRockwell.com. And that story is perfectly infuriating on many levels and incomprehensible to anybody in which there can be found a flicker of human decency. I tell the story, and this is based on court documents that were recently made public in Oklahoma, a town called El Reno, Oklahoma. Last December, an 86-year-old grandmother was visited by her adult grandson. He became concerned over the question of her medication. She's on a whole suite of medications. He didn't know what she had taken and what she had let go. So he called 911, hoping that an emergency medical technician or just a doctor would show up and perform an examination to see if grandmother was okay. This is an 86-year-old woman confined to a therapeutic bed, tethered to an oxygen bottle. Instead of a med tech, about half the local police department showed up, and they bowled their way into the bedroom, and she was understandably distraught and said, "Look, I don't need the police here. Would you please leave?" And she did so in a way that was perceived as aggressive. Bear in mind, this is an 86-year-old bedridden grandmother we're talking about. the police officer in charge of this contingent ordered another police officer to taser the grandmother. She's lying prone in a bed strapped to an oxygen bottle. The grandson said, "Don't tase my grandmother," and he was threatened with being tased. He was thrown to the floor, handcuffed, and stuffed in the back of a car. After he was taken out of the picture, after he was removed, a police officer stepped on the oxygen line, cut off the oxygen supply to the grandmother, and she was tasered twice, once in the mid-chest. There were two separate probes. One of them didn't fire, apparently. The other one did. And after she was stunned and electrocuted, after, of course, having her oxygen cut off, she was handcuffed and then taken to the hospital first, where she was treated for burns and lacerations, and then she was put in a psychiatric ward for 6 days. And the reason why this was done, according to the police officer's official report, is that she had displayed an aggressive posture while she was flat on her back receiving oxygen from a tube. Now, there's a lawsuit, of course, that's been filed here, and we'll find out a little bit more about what's going on. But if you want a really good museum-quality exhibit of what's gone wrong with the law enforcement culture in our country, I can't think of a better example than that. But that was posted on LouRockwell.com this morning on the blog section of that website. The Drudge Report picked up on it, and all day long I've been dealing with email, almost all of them from people who are outraged, a handful of them people who are outraged at me for criticizing the police. I criticize government with perfect equity. If you're talking about an abuse of power, I don't really care what element of the government you work for. As far as I'm concerned, they're all equally liable to criticism when they do something that's outrageous of this sort. But that's a good sort of cook's tour of what I'm offering and what I'm putting out in terms of the blog and the website and the radio program. As you mentioned, Dr. Stan, at Pro Libertate, the blog, I do have a place where people who have the means and are interested in doing so can offer donations by way of PayPal. At the bottom of every blog essay, there's a PayPal button that people can use if they are connected to PayPal or if they have a credit or debit card and want to make a donation. And that is pretty much the source of my livelihood and the means I'm relying on to support my family of eight. And so I really appreciate the fact that you make a point of letting your audience know about this. And many generous people in your audience have been very good to me and helped keep that blog site up and running. And for that, I'm very grateful.
Well, I remember what a hard time I had getting you to put the PayPal button on there. William didn't want to do that, but we finally talked him into it after about 2 months of nagging at him, and I'm so glad it's worked out. You go right ahead.
Well, we were talking before the break about this incredible statement by Christopher Dodd about the extent of the invasiveness of this financial reform measure that he admits probably won't work. I mean, what he said is we have no idea how it will work, and we won't until it's up and running. And then he goes even further by saying this is about as important as it gets because it deals with every single aspect of our lives. Now, think about this for a second. You've got people who presume the authority to regulate, to regiment every aspect of what we do. And this so-called financial reform bill will have a direct impact on anybody who has a bank account, anybody who writes a check, anybody who uses a credit card or a debit card, of course, people who have loans, mortgages, people who rely on short-term credit in order to finance their businesses. You're talking, for instance, about grocery stores. You're talking about people who are independent truckers. These are people who will be affected by this measure. And what they're doing, of course, is they're creating yet another sort of limited rescript dictator in terms of this official who would be in the Federal Reserve System with the power to propound these new regulations, enforce them, and seize whatever financial businesses he thinks are suitable for seizure. And this is all being done by people who don't know whether or not what they're going to do is going to work. But that, of course, doesn't lead them to the type of self-aware humility that would bring about a refusal of that particular grant of power. I mean, they understand that what they're doing may not work, but they see nothing at all wrong with using us as experimental guinea pigs in their grand social designs. And this is the sort of thing that President Obama and his entourage are trying to urge on the Europeans right now. And while this is going on, of course, you also have the Federal Reserve pumping out heavenly knows how much money to backstop the central banks of Europe. And so the dirty deal here, at least implicitly, is that if you want to spend it, we'll inflate it. We'll inflate and you spend. And you put basically the full faith and credit of the United States government, such as it is, behind this project of keeping government spending up and running and roaring at its current level or even higher level in Europe while doing the same thing here in the United States. And this is completely unsustainable. There's just no way that this is going to result in anything other than an unprecedented economic collapse.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting. Apparently, there's even dissension, if we can believe what we're reading in the newspapers, in the Federal Reserve System. And Mr. Bernanke has already put out a couple of $1 trillion to buy up these mortgages, these defaulting mortgages. And there are a lot of them out there, and he's really talking about having to put up another couple of $1 trillion.
Yep.
I mean, money they don't have, they're just creating out of nothing. Well, apparently, there's some people on the Federal Reserve Board on the Open Market Committee who think this is a terrible idea, and there's several of the chairmen of the major Federal Reserve banks are saying we've got to stop this. This is going to end up, of course, destroying the value of our currency, inflating it away. You can't keep putting out all this money that doesn't exist, creating it out of nothing. And so basically, you know, there's this real rift for the first time, really. They tried the stimulus. It didn't work. They put out another couple of $1 trillion. You know, they just created out of nothing. I don't even know where that money come from. They talk about another $2 or $3 trillion, and suddenly people are saying we can't do this. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this thing unfolds, because if they continue the current course, they will destroy the value of our currency, and they're knowing exactly what they're doing. I think Mr. Bernanke suddenly realized he has a tiger by the tail, and he doesn't know what to do.
Well, none of them knows what to do. I do appreciate the fact that Dodd was at least candid enough to admit that they don't know if this is going to work. They don't know how it would work. But for some reason, that candor didn't beget humility. You'd think that people who are aware of the fact that they're engaged in this kind of irresponsible experimentation, literally with the livelihoods of hundreds of millions, billions of people, would at some point eschew the role, the self-appointed role of would-be savior, and would simply get out of the way and let the economy heal itself. But there, one of the things you talk about constantly, Dr. Stan, I do appreciate you doing this, because this is so vital, and it's such an underappreciated or widely unappreciated element of what's going on, is the fact that there is a religious subtext to all of this. And the most benign construction you can put on the religious beliefs or convictions of the people we're discussing right now is that they are hopelessly devoted to the cult of self-worship. They actually believe that they have some kind of divine or quasi-divine insight, that they're oracular in terms of their vision, that they're bottomlessly benevolent and they're endlessly competent, and that they are made of such finer stuff than the rest of us, you know, the common run of humanity, that like the guardians in Plato's ideal state, they have the duty, not merely the power, not merely the privilege, but the duty of regimenting the rest of us and ordaining how we will live. And then, and this is something else you talk about as well, and Plato talked about in the Republic, creating the needful lies that are used to organize people in a way that will keep them, if not devoted, at least docile. And when you see how these people actually function, and one of the luxuries of the position we're living in right now, the era that we're living in, is that when you have an event like the G20 summit in Toronto, because of social networking, because of the internet, and because of amateur journalism, you can get a better and more tangible perception of what's going on. But you see how these people literally lock themselves away in conclaves, and they're surrounded by people who are literally dressed like stormtroopers from a dystopian science fiction novel, and they use brutal and pitiless tactics to deal with people who are perceived as posing some kind of a threat, if only the threat that would come from accurately describing within the security perimeter what's going on. That's really the heart of the system here. I mean, they're motivated by fear as much as anything else, because at some level they know that they're not the people, the beings that they presume to be. They know that they're not some kind of high exalted, holy, sanctified personages who have the type of intellect, the type of pure and virtuous motives that would lead them to manage an economy of any size in a way that would be equitable and productive. I mean, I think that Ben Bernanke, at some point, no later than about early 2008, knew that he didn't have anything else in his bag of tricks. I'm pretty sure that he's been running on empty since then, and I'm sure that, you know, Greenspan knew the same thing well into the beginning of his term. I mean, for heaven's sake, he's somebody who knew and wrote about the fallacies of the people who manage the economy and orchestrate booms and busts. But he was turned. You know, he sold his soul in the buyer's market, and I'm sure the same is true of Bernanke, and that's what they want the rest of us to do.
Well, they think that they can solve the problem by just creating more money. And as Bernanke had said, I think about 2002, you know, we don't have to worry. Oh, you never will have deflation because, of course, we can just turn on the printing press. And if we have to, we can throw the money out of helicopters. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they've been throwing it out of the helicopters. It hasn't done any good. What are you going to do now? Well, we're going to be back in just a moment, I guess. This evening has been William Grigg, and we'll be back in a moment to wrap up the program. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, Dr. Stan, thanks again for having me on this evening. And this, of course, is...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it. We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand, call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.